Hello, and welcome to the GLAR podcast, the Global Law at Reading podcast. I'm your host, as always, Professor James Green. Apologies that we've not had a GLAR podcast in some while. I'm afraid it's been a very busy time here at GLAR Central. But I'm delighted to introduce this podcast, which features a presentation by Dr. Philippa Webb, who's a reader in public international law at the Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London, and is also a barrister at 20 Essex Street Chambers. Dr. Webb presented to us at Reading as part of the Gandhi Research Seminar series for 2016-17. In fact, it was the last seminar in that series for the 2016-17 academic year. It took place on the 26th of April 2017, and the paper was entitled The Right to Insult in International Law. It was chaired by me, so you will hear this voice again shortly. I hope you enjoy that presentation. As ever, please get in touch with us. We like to hear your thoughts on these podcasts or on the work of the Global Law at Reading grouping more generally. So you can email us globallaw@reading.ac.uk, or you can also follow us on Twitter at UNIRDG_GLAR. I'm very pleased to welcome for the final Gandhi Research Seminar of the 16-17 academic year, Dr. Philippa Webb, who's a reader in public international law at the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. Dr. Webb has an extensive CV that I won't eat into her time by going through, but I will say that it includes a significant amount of and varied involvement with international legal practice. And so as well as being a reader at King's at the moment, Dr. Webb's also a barrister at 20 Essex Street Chambers, and so is appearing before domestic courts and international courts. You've just been telling me about all this. How you find the time, I have no idea, as well as being an academic. Her paper today is on the right to insult in international law, and I'll hand over to Dr. Webb.
Thank you. Well, thank you to Professor Green and to all of you for having me. It's my first time to the University of Reading, and I'm delighted to be here with the Global Law at Reading's Gandhi Research Seminar Series.
I didn't make you say that. You didn't have to read all that out.
So I'm speaking about the right to insult in international law. I've got some PowerPoint slides. I don't know how visible they'll be with this bright sunshine. But they're mainly extracting the treaty provisions with which you're probably familiar anyway. So this is based on an article that I co-wrote with a colleague that was published just last month in Columbia Human Rights Law Review. And it's a topic on which I think there's much to say these days. We have a president using Twitter to share random, often insulting thoughts at 3 a.m., bloggers being imprisoned for satirical poetry, ISIS using social media to glorify and encourage violence, and also counter-terrorism laws being used conversely to suppress genuine debate in some countries. States all over the world are enacting laws to criminalise insults or using existing laws with renewed vigour. Today, in many states, it is a criminal offence to insult what we call the three R's: royalty, rulers, or religion. And today I noticed that the World Press Freedom Index was released, and the UK has slipped to number 40 on that index, the US to 43. And the Reporters Without Borders, who published this index, say that there is a very serious situation regarding freedom of expression in 72 countries, including Russia, China, and India. Under international law, freedom of expression is regulated by three main treaties: the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, or CERD, and the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which has a specific provision on incitement to genocide. And what emerges from these three treaties is what we call a spectrum or a sliding scale of the criminalisation of hate speech. So at one end, what's completely and uncontroversially impermissible is hate speech that incites genocide, and that's directly from the Genocide Convention. A bit further along to the middle, we have hate speech that incites violence, so not a specific intent to destroy a group. Further along, hate speech that doesn't incite violence but incites hatred or discrimination. And at the more permissible end, merely insulting, disturbing, or shocking speech. So in the middle, we have what's called a grey zone. To what extent do we criminalise hate speech that incites hatred or discrimination, or that which incites violence but not genocidal violence? I plan to do three things this afternoon. I'm going to spend a bit of time setting out state practice along this spectrum, just to give you a sense of the variety but also the widespread nature of state practice in this area. Then I'm going to talk about the international legal framework and also some critiques we have of some of its features. And then I'm going to propose 8 recommendations for protecting freedom of expression and the right to insult. The basic recommendation is that imprisonment for speech should be reserved for the most dangerous forms of insulting speech that intentionally and directly incite imminent or concretely identified violence or criminal offences. And perhaps we can discuss that recommendation and others in the Q&A session. So first to the state practice on insult. We have to begin by having some sense of what we mean by insult. So an insult is obviously ordinary meaning, an offensive statement. But it could arise because someone is being deliberately provocative. It can also arise through carelessness, recklessness, a lack of attention to how words are being received. An insult may stigmatise minorities, or it can also challenge those in power or blow the whistle on some kind of unlawful conduct. Now, there's a wide range of state practice that criminalises insulting behaviour, and it's not necessarily under some law that talks about offensive statements. It can come in through many forms of legislation, and I'm going to give examples under each of these. So the most prominent one is criminal defamation laws. We're all familiar with civil defamation. You insult someone. If it reaches a legal test in that jurisdiction, then you are liable to pay damages to that person. And most countries that have civil defamation will provide exceptions or justifications, such as the speech being true, the speech reflecting an honestly held opinion, or a speech about a matter of public interest. But many states also have criminal defamation on their books, and they do not include the same exceptions as they do for civil defamation. So you don't have a political speech exception, for example. 23 of the 28 member states of the EU criminalise defamation. Happily, the UK does not. It used to, but it changed its laws. And in 20 of these countries, imprisonment is the penalty for defamation. And this is actually being used. In the last 5 years, journalists in 15 EU countries have been convicted of defamation in criminal trials. The next category is sedition. So this is where it's a crime to insult the government specifically. Indian law today criminalises a speaker who, and I quote, brings or attempts to bring into hatred or contempt, or excites or attempts to excite disaffection towards the government. Fairly vague wording. Most Arab countries also have these laws. China criminalises the, quote, incitement of subversion of state power. And in Europe, many states have laws that make it a crime to insult the head of state or other political figures. In Germany, defaming the president can land you in prison for up to 5 years. And these laws don't just exist in paper. Once again, they are being used. In Malaysia right now, a cartoonist faces 43 years in prison for sedition because he posted cartoons on Twitter that mocked the government and their trial of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. In Botswana, an editor faces 3 years in prison for sedition, not for something that he personally wrote, but because he published a story in his newspaper that claimed the president of Botswana failed to report a road traffic accident. And this is so offensive, it's been labelled sedition, and he's facing 3 years in prison. And we all know that in Turkey, thousands of people have been imprisoned in a 2-year period under the specific law that makes it a crime to insult President Erdogan. And that World Press Index report that I mentioned that came out today has called Turkey the world's biggest prison for media professionals. It is ranked 155 on the index. Anti-discrimination laws, somewhat counterintuitively, are also being used to prosecute insults. In South Africa, there are already civil penalties for someone that promotes or propagates hatred against minorities. But the South African Parliament currently has a bill before it on criminalising hate speech. And it says any direct or electronic communication that advocates hatred or incites others to harm or causes contempt or ridicule, up to 10 years in prison. And in the Netherlands, we all know about Geert Wilders, the far-right politician. He was convicted for hate speech under Dutch law for calling for fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands. Now, all of these things, well, not all of these things, but in that particular instance of Wilders, of course it's offensive and racist and insulting what he says. But our argument in this paper is that it shouldn't be criminal. Terrorism laws are also being used. These often have vague wording that authorities are able to exploit to imprison journalists or opposition leaders. One unusual case was in Spain, where two puppeteers were arrested on the charge of glorifying terrorism because they had a puppet show in Madrid that depicted a policeman puppet trying to catch a witch puppet who was holding up a sign linking her to Al-Qaeda and the secessionist group ETA. So they were imprisoned on that basis. And the puppeteer said, well, this merely proves the point we were trying to make, which is that counterterrorism laws are used for witch hunts. We all hear about fake news these days, and there are many countries with laws on the book prohibiting and criminalising fake news, especially in the Arab region and Asia. In China, a 2013 law, so these are recent developments, establishes that it is a crime to be, quote, a rumour monger. This is defined as any individual who posts a false rumour that is then reposted 500 times or viewed 5,000 times. And as you know, Egyptian prosecutors prosecuted the entire senior staff of Al Jazeera in Cairo under a false news law in 2014. And they were convicted at the highest level and were only released due to a pardon. Public order laws are also being employed to criminalise insult. Another famous case in Russia, the all-girl band Pussy Riot, was imprisoned for 2 years. They had sung a song that said, banish Putin, banish Putin, banish Putin. They were charged with hooliganism and put in prison on that basis. Blasphemy laws are increasingly being used for prosecutions and often carry the most harsh penalties. In Saudi Arabia, a blogger named Raif Badawi published atheist views online and received 1,000 lashes and 10 years in prison. In Myanmar, a cafe owner from New Zealand was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison and hard labour for insulting Buddhism because he used an image of Buddha wearing headphones in a post on Facebook. And then finally, we have the category of lèse majesté, which is specifically insults to royalty. Thailand is the most famous example of this. They have had numerous prosecutions under their lèse majesté law. The most egregious one is a factory worker who posted a sarcastic message on the internet about the king's dog. Not the king, the king's dog, and faces 37 years in prison under this law. And as I've mentioned, even in Europe, it's a crime to insult royalty in many countries, punishable by up to 5 years in prison in the Netherlands and Norway, for example. So what is international law saying about this extensive use of legislation to suppress freedom of expression? We have to look, firstly, at the ICCPR, the International Covenant, Article 19. And this has two parts that are relevant. So the first two paragraphs set out this extensive right to freedom of expression that we are to enjoy. But then Article 19, paragraph 3, sets out the basis on which it can be restricted. So for respect of the rights or reputations of others, for the protection of national security, public order, or public health or morals. And one of our critiques are that these words are vague and open to abuse. The International Covenant also has a specific provision in Article 20, paragraph 2, which prohibits any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, and that this is to be prohibited by law. The UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression has clarified that Article 20 does not mean that states have to criminalise speech, but that it may be appropriate in the most serious instances of incitement to hatred. And then we turn to the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Article 4, which requires states to outlaw racially motivated hate speech. So this says that states shall declare an offence, which has been interpreted as a criminal offence, punishable by law for the dissemination of ideas based on racial superiority, hatred, incitement to racial discrimination, as well as all acts of violence. So this is a summary of these three provisions. I've also mentioned earlier the genocide provision, which is very specific as it's limited to incitement to genocide. So you can, and this is a point I'll be coming back to, there is a tension in these three key provisions. They're not setting up a perfectly clear and coherent framework for the regulation of offensive speech. So Article 20, paragraph 2, which prohibits the advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred, goes further in restricting speech than Article 19.3. Whereas Article 19 allows for a restriction of speech if it's in the interest of respect for the rights or reputations of others, Article 20 has mandatory language. It requires the restriction of any speech that constitutes such advocacy. But then Article 4 of the CERD goes even further by requiring the criminalisation of certain hate speech of a racist nature. So in our view, and what we say in the paper, is that the right to insult is not sufficiently protected under international law. International standards, not just the law in the treaties, but also how it's been applied by the various bodies, has proved to be confusing and inadequate. So just to take Article 4 as an example of CERD. It's limited to speech that is discriminatory on racial grounds, which is understandable given the nature of the convention. But this seems to highlight the arbitrary nature of the standard. Why is racial discrimination more damaging than discrimination based on religious, ethnic, sectarian, political grounds or sexual orientation? Article 4 is not only oppressive of a free society with free exchanges of expression, but it also fails to protect the interests of victims of discrimination on an equal basis. Such vague and inconsistent bases for restricting speech are inherently open to abuse by undemocratic authorities or even democratic authorities that may have a particular agenda. It also even leads to well-meaning bodies within the UN system having conflicting interpretations, leaving us confused as to what speech may result in a prison term. And these concerns are not just hypothetical. The Human Rights Committee, which monitors the implementation of the ICCPR, and the CERD Committee, which monitors implementation of the Racial Discrimination Convention, as well as the European Court of Human Rights, have been reaching divergent conclusions on the right to insult. And they have tolerated a high level of criminalisation of such speech. So let me just take as an example, and this hasn't come before the courts, and I can't believe I'm about to say something that's slightly positive about Donald Trump, but just to take an example. During the presidential election campaign, he referred to Mexicans as rapists, and he suggested that all Muslims should be prevented from entering the United States, and he's since attempted to put that into law through executive orders. Now, certainly, this can be said to advocate hatred on national or religious grounds. It can certainly be said to inspire discrimination, if not also hostility. I fully agree that this speech is offensive and insulting, But this should not mean that the speaker should be subjected to legal penalties for saying it, let alone a prison term. And under the interpretation, particularly of the third provision, Article 4, he would be open to criminalisation for that speech. His speech would be open to criminalisation. So an approach that would be more protective of the right to insult doesn't mean there's going to be no action taken against such offensive speech and behaviour. One example that keeps coming up is the use that ISIS makes of social media. And we argue that since the very purpose of ISIS is violence, the speech that they use, the recruitment speech in particular, would pass the test that we've set for intent to incite imminent or concretely identified violence. So we would support criminalisation of such speech when the very purpose of the group is violence. But there's also a myriad of non-legal tools that we can use to deal with insulting speech, insulting behaviour. First of all, we believe that insults should be heard, debated, rebutted, vigorously challenged. Politicians and other public officials can play a crucial role in condemning such instances of hate speech. Civil society organisations have already been playing an important role in identifying, rebutting, and demystifying such speech. Technology is a tool that's been used to propagate such speech. It can also be a tool to create communities for constructive dialogue. A free press is vital to communicating information and ideas to the public, and training and community initiatives can also improve understanding of the effects of such insulting behaviour. The current approach of criminalisation in many countries is not working. There is no compelling evidence that the criminalisation of insults has led to a reduction in racially inspired violent crime, for example. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has conducted a study on this, and they've said, and I quote, "The criminal model is not an efficient tool when it comes to addressing the real causes of discrimination. The massive presence of criminal regulations does not seem to have made a meaningful contribution to reducing racism or other discriminatory conduct." And the EU Parliament recently conceded that hate speech and hate crimes are on the rise despite robust criminal laws in EU countries targeting such speech. Criminalising insults can also be counterproductive. You're drawing attention and giving a platform to certain provocateurs. So the far-right Dutch politician I've mentioned, Geert Wilders, a genocide denier, Dogu Perinçek, who denies the Armenian genocide, deliberately travel to places and make speeches where they know they'll be arrested so that they can land on the front cover of the newspaper and get additional publicity for their causes. So some of our critiques of these this international legal framework include the fact that there are vague and anachronistic grounds for restricting speech. Many of these treaties were adopted after World War II, when obviously the type of discrimination and genocide and the Holocaust were very much in the minds of the drafters. So they've allowed restrictions on vague grounds that made sense in that context. So respect for the rights of others, propaganda for war, protection of public morals. But these terms are vague and they haven't been well defined in the jurisprudence of UN bodies, and they have left a large scope for abuse. So, for instance, criminal defamation, to take it as an example. International bodies have diverged on whether defamation should be criminalised. So the UN Human Rights Committee and the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression strongly recommend the decriminalisation of defamation, and they say imprisonment should never be a penalty. The regional courts, including the European Court, have said, well, criminalisation can occur in exceptional cases, and a prison sentence for hate speech or incitement to violence. Whereas the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination says that it's fine to criminalise defamation. Okay, so even within international courts and international treaty bodies, we have the whole range of views, and there's no attempt to really engage with each other and try to reach a coherent position. Another example where we've seen a divergence between the bodies is genocide denial laws. The UN Human Rights Committee says that such denial laws, so for instance, that would imprison someone for denying that the Holocaust occurred, which is on the books in Switzerland, Austria and Germany, for example. The Human Rights Committee has said that such denial laws are incompatible with freedom of expression, whereas regional courts, such as the European Court, have said that they are compatible with freedom of expression, and such prosecutions do not breach the European Convention. And sometimes we even have internal inconsistencies. The Human Rights Committee has been very changeable on the intent requirement for inciting violence as a result of insulting speech. Sometimes they say you don't need intent, sometimes they say a lower level of intent, and sometimes they say specific intent, just depending on the facts of the case. So we believe that the law should be setting a clearer standard, and we also believe that there should be the narrowest possible basis for criminalising insulting speech. And we take our inspiration, but it's not a clear adaptation, from the US First Amendment jurisprudence. So as you know, the First Amendment of their constitution protects freedom of expression. And when you look, there's extensive jurisprudence that's built up around the interpretation of the First Amendment. And there's two principles that emerge that we find compelling. First, we believe insulting speech should be protected unless it's intended to and likely to produce imminent violence or other unlawful behaviour. In the US, the jurisprudence says there's only three categories of unprotected speech, so that's speech for which you can be prosecuted, and they are called fighting words, incitement to imminent lawless action, and true threats. And they all depend on the factual matrix, but the common thread between them is that you have to have a concrete link to violence or a breach of the peace if that speech is to be criminalised. The second principle from the US jurisprudence is that content-based or viewpoint-based restrictions will rarely be compatible with freedom of expression. Judges are not to base their decisions on their own preferences about what content of speech should be heard or suppressed. So, we have come up with 8 recommendations, starting first, the first 4 are at the national level, and the recommendations 5 through 8 are at the international level. So, at the national level, I repeat our standard that we've formulated, inspired by the US jurisprudence, that the law should recognise a right to insult. An insult should only be criminalised if it is intended to incite violence or criminal offence, and it is likely to produce such violence or offence. So there's a subjective element, that there was an intent to incite violence, and there's an objective element, that it was likely. Second, that insulting the 3 R's, rulers, royalty or religion, should not be criminalised. Third, that insulting victims of a historical event through revisionism or genocide denial should not be criminalised, and in that we favour the position of the Human Rights Committee over that of the European Court of Human Rights, who have reached opposing views. Fourth, laws on counter-terrorism, public order or other offences should not be used to criminalise speech that is merely insulting. And then at the international level, we think CERD Article 4 should just be deleted by the agreement of states parties or excluded through reservations. There's no way to interpret it that would bring it in line with the tests that we propose. Article 20, however, we think can be interpreted in a compatible way if states enter reservations, that they would only follow Article 20 of the ICCPR if the speech is intentionally inciting violence and it's likely to follow. Seventh, vague and anachronistic concepts should not be relied on to justify the criminalisation of insults. So these notions of public morals, propaganda for war, shouldn't be exploited for their vagueness. And finally, this is not something I've had time to discuss, but it's in our article. Article 17 of the European Convention of Human Rights and its equivalent in the ICCPR, Article 5, should not apply to freedom of expression cases because they're a way for the court to basically short-circuit any balancing exercise and just say this is offensive is not protected by the convention. We also think that these 8 recommendations, obviously they're directed to international bodies and courts and national governments, but we also think that they should guide in a non-binding way the private sector, which are really the gateway to handling online content that is considered insulting. So Facebook, Twitter, Google, Instagram, etc. At the moment, most of them have sort of community guidelines that are almost as vague as some of these treaty provisions, and we think there can be more clarity there.